This is the Concealed Carry Podcast, episode number 83. And welcome to the Concealed Carry Podcast, part of the USA Firearm Training Network, and I am your host, Riley Bowman. And Happy New Year, everybody. Welcome to 2017. We are so excited and looking forward to a great new year. And today's episode is, well, a little different than normal because with the holiday and a bunch of travel that I am doing and Jacob is also doing to some extent, we are doing a best of episode today. So a collection of some of the best episodes that we've had on the podcast so far in the last year. And we really hope that you will enjoy listening to these excerpts that our sound guy, Corey, has gone through very diligently and pulled out for us. And anyway, we want to thank all of you for your support of the Concealed Carry Podcast in the last year. We're looking forward to a fantastic 2017. A lot of great and exciting things coming our way and your way as well. So we really look forward to that. So without any further ado, let's get right into the best of the Concealed Carry Podcast. See you later. Today's topic is to tell or not to tell, dealing with law enforcement as a responsible gun owner.
Alex, what would the officer want us to do? Let's take it from the officer's perspective. In an ideal world, what do you want the permittee or the gun owner to do?
Well, you know, this is interesting because when you ask that question, you have to look at what the individual officer wants. And there's as many individual officers and individual thoughts on this as there are individual gun owners. So this is from a benefactor member of the National Rifle Association telling you that when I walk up to the car, I will ask, after I've explained the nature of the stop, I'll ask for your driver's license, vehicle registration, and proof of insurance. In Colorado, we're issued a hard copy of a concealed carry permit. And one thing that I've always liked is when someone hands me their information, if they put their permit underneath their driver's license. So the first thing I see is the driver's license. And then as I separate the documents, I get the concealed carry permit, the proof of insurance, and the vehicle registration. So when I see that, in Colorado, you have to undergo a background check to get a concealed carry permit. So I and most other police officers realize that our concealed carry holders are actually more law-abiding and been vetted better than the average citizen who doesn't have a concealed carry permit. After I see the permit, I'm going to ask a few questions. I'm going to say, I see that you have a concealed carry permit. Without touching your firearm, do you have it with you now? That's a yes or no question. Depending on the response, if it's yes, I'll say, without touching your firearm, where is it at now? And then the holder will tell me. And in Colorado, you're required to do that. And then the final thing I'm going to say is during the entire duration of this contact, you are not to touch that firearm for any reason. Do you understand? I'm going to get an affirmative response. And if they shake their head, I'll ask them, I'm sorry, I didn't hear you. I want that on tape. Mm-hmm. At this point, everything is taken care of, and I'll go back to my car. One of the things that I do know what it's like to be stopped by the police, I've been stopped a couple times. I'll ask a person, if I can see someone's really tense, I'll say, so, while we're done now, can I ask you a question? What are you carrying? And if this guy says, oh, I got an STI, it's got the enhanced recoil muzzle brake type thing, right away I know I got a competitive shooter here, and I have something that I can latch on to and help that person understand that I'm here doing my job, and I want them to feel comfortable with me. I don't think it's us against them. It's us against the criminals. And one thing that I've been hearing a lot of people respond to in Colorado, when they palm their, we call it palming, when they palm the permit to the officer will say, I don't need this. But again, they've acknowledged that you have it. And you've given that officer the ability to make an informed decision. You know, just be safe, be smart. I agree with what you said, know the laws. Don't overreact. And whatever you do when the police show up at your car, don't let them see a gun in your hand or on the seat. That sets the stage for tragedy. Yeah. We can laugh about it, but a lot of times in our quest to do the right thing for the officer, we do make mistakes. And officers make mistakes too. And I don't want anybody in your audience or anybody in the motoring public to be subject to a mistake.
Today's topic, shooting to kill. Were you set up to fail? If ever faced with a situation where drawing a gun is warranted, what is the right thing to do? Do you shoot to kill? Shoot to wound? Is it ever appropriate to fire off warning shots? Are you ever required to issue a verbal warning? Or should you? We shoot to kill. If we draw the gun, we shoot to kill. Now, where does this come from? Well, I think where it comes from is people get the idea and they're taught that, hey, if you have justification to use deadly force, and of course talking about what that is a whole other topic, but if you have that justification and you draw your weapon and you're going to use it, you should be shooting for, you know, center of mass, you know, basically kill shot, right? Because, you know, do we want to shoot to wound?
Yeah, you bring up a really good point. That is, what's the foundation behind the idea? Why do people feel that it's the right thing to do to shoot to kill? And you're dead on, right? Shooting to wound is a real bad idea. We don't want to try and injure people. Here's the key, and I think, you know, to unbury the lead here and just put it out front, the objective when you are engaged in any sort of self-defense, firearm-related or otherwise, the objective is to stop the threat or threats as quickly and efficiently as possible. And so when it comes to stopping threats, I mean, if you're Jason Bourne, by all means, shoot people in the kneecaps and, you know, that'll probably stop them pretty well. Maybe it won't, you know, but most of us don't have the efficiency, the training, or what else is necessary to have that kind of aim under that kind of circumstance. We train, and the way we should train, if you don't already, is to hit the largest target that's most likely to stop the threat, which is center mass. We're talking about chest, you know, we're talking about, you know, basically rib cage and up to neck. So that is the center mass. That's where we're most likely to stop threats. It's the biggest target, easiest to hit, and most likely to do the job.
True. Yeah. You know, if we were to actually look up in the dictionary now, it's not in the, you know, Merriam-Webster's dictionary, but if we define center of mass, that is the center, the average center of the largest part of the body that we are able to see. Right. And so if we're face on to somebody, yeah, that's center of the chest. But if we only see a head, you know, poking around a corner, you know, center of mass in that situation would be center of the head if that's all that we can see and shoot at. But yeah, the point is we shoot to stop the threat. And this is key. Now, sometimes this is a hard concept for some of my students that come through classes to grasp. And I really want to make sure that when they do, that they do grasp this difference. It's a very distinct change in, you know, it's kind of a paradigm shift for some people. So I, you know, we talk about the shoot to kill versus shoot to stop a threat. And to some people, it's the same thing, but it is and it isn't, because here's the distinction. Who is going to judge you if you are charged with a crime? It's most likely a jury.
Judge and a jury, yeah.
Right. And what they are looking at in deadly force cases is, you know, first, there's a couple of things. What was the intent of the person, you know, you that's being judged? Assuming that's what it comes to, right? Was this person's intent to kill? Because killing, by the way, it's illegal the last time I checked. There's these few exceptions where using deadly force is allowed. But what is the intent in those situations? And if you look at the law very closely, now we're not attorneys here, so you know, take that with a grain of salt. And you know, we're not giving you advice or legal interpretation here. And watch out for our, you know, our gun law course that we are still editing and putting together. But if you look at the law, it talks about threats to an individual. And so the use of deadly force in all these situations is to prevent or to stop this threat that's against you or your home.
Yeah, you talk about that legal kind of paradigm shift, which I think is very important. I also want to address, I think, the two other common justifications that I hear from people when they talk about shooting to kill. One is that they think that, if I don't kill this person dead, they're going to jump up and sue me and charge me. And they're going to be another witness in my court case. And not only do I have ethical issues about that, like somehow, jail right. time and money is more valuable than the human life. But right. but I think more importantly, people don't understand that, A, that's not really a reality. There were some instances of that, 30 plus years ago that I think became part of the rhetoric of our community, where now people think, kill them, the dead man can't talk kind of idea. But today, you're pretty, if you're protected from criminal prosecution because you're justified within the means of the law, you're probably also protected from civil litigation. Now, almost always the case. Now, not always, but for the most part. And even if you're not, judges and juries have evolved. The court system has evolved. The legal system has evolved. And you're probably not as liable as you think. But even if, put all that aside, even if that weren't true, what you probably should know is that dead people can and do sue you. It's just true. Dead people do sue. And we're going to actually talk about that in next week's episode. But dead people will sue you. So that's a really poor justification for wanting to kill someone dead because I don't want them to be able to talk. I mean, ask O.J. Simpson about his dead wife's lawsuit. She was really good at suing him. Right. And she was dead. Yeah. So that's how that works. The other one, and you can speak to this one, right, a little bit more. But I hear people say this all the time. They say, well, the other reason we should kill people is because they don't deserve to live. this is a criminal. They broke into my home or they're trying to kill me or something. And so, right. one less, bad guy, good riddance, that's why we should kill him dead.
And that's a common line of thought. And it's the wrong line of thought because there's a term for that and it's called vigilante justice. Right. And, we actually had an example with this similar to this, recently here in Colorado. We had a man that, his home was broken into. He was taken and bound by these intruders, and he somehow managed to escape from his ties or whatever. He had a gun that he was able to get access to. He draws his gun and he fires shots at these intruders as they were going about his house and stuff and taking things, and he ends up chasing them out of the house. And in fact, I think they even steal his car, and he chases them to the car. And as they're leaving the house, he's shooting at them outside of his house. He's shooting at them down the street as they're leaving, chasing them. And he's in major hot water right now because he tried to take the law into his own hands.
People should go back and listen to our first episode of this podcast where we talked about citizens' arrest and where you can cross the line and get into big trouble, because we go into very depth about the legal parameters around this. But I love what you're saying about the ethical issues here.
Yeah. I'm sure what was going through this guy's head, well, maybe not a whole lot was going through his head. He may have just been reacting. But that's also why we got to decide ahead of time why or what we're going to do in situations like this. The ethical side of it is that it's not up to me or you, or anybody, any one individual to decide whether a person lives or dies. And that's not the issue when it comes to using deadly force. The use of deadly force is for stopping a threat. The major concern to me is this threat against my life. When that threat is no longer there, whether because they leave or because they're down on the ground because I've shot them or whatever, then I stop, because that's all I'm concerned with. I'm not concerned with this other person, whether they live or die, whether they face justice or not. The law only addresses if the threat to my life or the life of a loved one or whatever is over. That's it. Today's topic is the biggest concealed carry mistakes. So I'm going to jump right in and I'm going to go with my number one. These are not in any particular order, by the way. And I just thought, just by default, I couldn't help myself but to go with kind of one of these really basic concealed carry mistakes. At least this is one that's basic for me. But I suspect, and I've seen it, that there are people that maybe don't realize that some of the little tics and habits and, you know, just nuances to how they handle themselves and go about their day, they may not realize that sometimes these lead to, you know, them exposing their gun or having it print. And which actually is kind of another topic in of itself as to what's the problem with that, you know. Now, a lot of our listeners may very well live in a location where open carry is not allowed. Or, you know, and in Colorado, you know, where we're based, it is an open carry state, but we do have the city and county of Denver that does not allow open carry. And sometimes you might be in locations where open carry, for instance, like a city office building. Near where I live, there's a, you know, a building where you can go in there carrying concealed. It's city government offices, but they do have specifically posted no open carrying. So in places like this, you got to be careful. But also, too, there's a tactical part, too. I think it's best that I carry concealed and that it remains concealed so that nobody knows I've got it. Number one, element of surprise. Number two, less attention on me. I don't want attention as being a gun owner. For any reason, I don't want law-abiding, just innocent folk noticing that I've got a gun, and I don't want the criminals to notice I have a gun. But anyway, number one for me is checking on the gun, all right? You've got this thing wedged in between your pant line and, you know, your skin, your back, your, you know, near your hip or whatever, and it is very tempting to sometimes go, oh, is it still there? You know, you get a really good, comfortable holster, for instance, like the Brave Response holster we talk about quite often, which for me has been one of the more comfortable holsters I've ever worn. And sometimes it's like, oh, is the gun still there?
Yeah, and, a little tap, tap, make sure it's still there.
You almost want to check, you know, like, but also too, I've had times or instances just because of the nature of what I was doing or how I was sitting or moving where I almost felt like maybe the gun moved or was becoming dislodged or something like that. And it's like, oh, you know, and like it's hard to sometimes fight the urge to check and make sure that it's there. So along with that, always get a quality holster that you're confident is going to, you know, hold the gun in place where it's supposed to be. And that allows you to, you know, draw the gun quickly too when you need it. So a good quality holster is a must. But also along with this caution on, you know, against checking on your gun periodically is, I think it's just a related thing. And so this is really two different of the mistakes. We have it listed as two mistakes in the article. But the second one I think is just very closely related. And that's adjusting your clothing, adjusting your pants. So sometimes, you know, once again, you feel like maybe the gun's not as secure as it should be, or maybe you don't have good quality pants or a good quality belt holding things in place. Try to avoid adjusting your belt, your pants, your clothing, things of that nature. Very common mistakes I see made all the time.
Yeah, I'm guilty of that. I mean, I know I have this, you said the word tick, which is what I would have used, where, you know, every time I stand up or get out of the car or anything where, you know, I was sitting, now I stand, I like almost naturally take my hand and just smooth out the back of my shirt.
Yeah,
almost like the woman who's afraid that, you know, her butt crack is showing. Like, you know, I do that all the time because I'm afraid the gun is now showing. And it's just a tick. Like, it's most of the time not necessary, but I do it out of habit. And it's I know it's a problem.
Yeah, I'll admit, in the way you described it, I'm guilty of too quite often as well. I've been in situations though for sure where it is necessary, and I have developed. I think someone that is watching for it and is aware. Particularly like maybe they're a concealed carry permittee themselves, they may notice, but I think for a lot of general public folk, you know, they may not notice. I've developed kind of a very smooth, natural way of adjusting my shirt or whatever when it gets caught like on the butt of the gun or some, you know, things of that nature where I do it very subtly, I think. I'd like you to let me know if it's not, Jacob, which sometimes that's a good thing too, is to have people that know you and your family members and things like that maybe let you in on things like, oh, by the way, dad or mom or grandpa or whatever, like when you do this, I noticed, you know, that sort of thing as well.
Yeah. So the first one I picked out from the list was the mistake is not doing dry fire practice. And I put in there, you know, laser simulation, because to me they are now, you know, one in the same, dry fire and laser simulation. But I think that gun owners, their vision in their mind of what training is going to a range and shooting at targets. But that really is just so insufficient. It's just such a small piece of the pie in terms of really being prepared, creating, you know, being able to practice the right things in the right way at the right speed without fear, building the right muscle memory, and training in an environment where you're most likely, you know, to need to defend yourself. So I think the number, you know, one mistake that I picked out of the list is, you know, we need to do more dry fire.
Totally. I've had the pleasure of knowing and associating with and talking with a number of professional shooters, and I like to talk to them about their practice habits, like how they train, how much time they spend training, how many rounds they fire over a given period of time. And so I know, I won't mention his name, but I know one professional shooter who he has several sponsors, but one of his sponsors is an ammunition company, of course, which is a great sponsor to have because then they send you a lot of free ammo. And he gets shipped every 6 months, I believe, or somewhere between 40 and 50,000 rounds of ammunition. So essentially, he's going through 40 to 50,000 rounds, 80 to 100,000 rounds per year, which is incredible and very awesome, I might add. But here's what's interesting that he told me. He doesn't just spend, you know, 100,000 rounds per year practicing. That's not the only, in fact, that's far from the only practice he does. He also spends a great deal of amount of time dry fire practicing. And he estimates probably 3 to 4 times the amount of time he spends actually on the range live fire. 3 to 4 times that at home, in his basement, whatever, doing dry fire.
Yeah, that makes so much sense. And this is a person who has all the time and,
you know, yeah, this is his job.
No excuse for cost. Yeah. And he still says, hey, you know what? I need to be doing 3 to 4 times as much dry fire as I do live fire.
Right.
And it just makes so much sense. Like, you know, the range won't let you do a lot of things you should do. The range has rules against drawing from the holster. The range may have rules against shooting at multiple targets or moving while shooting or, you know, rapid fire. The ranges have rules against that stuff. And furthermore, I've never been to a range where I can practice, like, you know, pieing a corner and moving into a room or going downstairs while holding a gun. Like, those are just things that ranges don't allow.
Right.
And I can do that at home, you know, in a safe environment. So I just think dry fire is so mission critical to getting enough repetition to build the right amount of muscle memory. And along those lines, I really, when I say dry fire, I really am talking about laser simulation. I think a person needs, you know, today our sponsor of this episode is the CERT. I use the CERT pistol along with the LASR software. And to me, that is the ultimate, you know, at home dry fire training program.
Yeah, same here. I use laser simulation training a lot. I mean, that is the bulk of my training, which is not any different than what my friend, the professional shooter, does. He admitted himself 3 to 4 times, you know, of actual live fire training is spent dry fire. Or I believe he also uses some laser simulation training tools as well. So it's this is what it takes for a world-class professional shooter to be the best, is a lot of practice and not just with the live fire stuff. How many rounds should you carry concealed every day? So this is the topic we'll be discussing today. We'll get Brandon's take on the issue, and Jacob and I will pipe in our thoughts.
The point is not that this guy shot 30-something rounds to cops. The point is that the cops shot 50-something rounds back, and that's what it took to stop him. And it's not like they suck. It's not like, oh, the cops shot 50-something shots. They only hit him twice. And, you know, no. They hit him like dozens of times, but he's still pulling the trigger.
Yep.
Yeah. In my classes, I watch this video with all of my students. And, you know, one of the big things that we ask is, okay, as you're watching this, I want you to count how many rounds this guy takes before he is no longer a threat to these police officers. So we go through the video and we're counting these rounds. And I mean, we're counting 15, 20, 25, 35. I mean, you know, we're counting all the way up to 54 rounds that these police officers fire. And it's somewhere in the, you know, the high 20s and the high, you know, high 20s, low 30s that this guy is no longer an imminent threat to these police officers.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I want to stick a pin in this real quick, guys, because if you're listening to this right now, I promise you, your brain is designed right now at this point in this podcast to start to convince yourself that this doesn't apply to you. So if you're thinking thoughts like, well, I'm not a cop, or I'm a better shot, or I carry this whatever, you know, Bushmaster, you know, range killer 5,000 gun with ammo that, you know, like whatever you're telling yourself right now, take a pause and say, no, I'm going to hear this out. And just stick with us and listen to all these arguments that, that Brandon's going to explain, because it does apply to you.
We talk about, well, you know, I only need 5 or 6 shots. You know, if mm-hmm. I shoot him in the head, they'll take care of it, right? And it's like, well, how hard in real life is it actually to make that headshot?
Totally.
Especially when your target is moving and you need to be moving. Mm-hmm. It's really, really, really difficult. I mean, it's something that should be trained. Like, you should be capable of making that shot at a static target at a range at a certain mm-hmm. distance. Absolutely. But in real life, that's a lot harder to do than the movies make it look, for sure.
Right. And that right there is the point. I think too often as shooters, we go to our indoor range and we stand in our static lane because, you know, we mm-hmm. don't want to be dangerous and you know, endanger our fellow gun owners' lives by moving and shooting a lot. But we'll stand there static in our static booth there at the range in our lane, and our static target is at you know, at whatever distance it is that you're training at that day. And we'll practice in this controlled environment when you can really focus, when you can really breathe. You know, we'll practice making that shot, and then sometimes I know I fall into this trap every once in a while. I'll walk away from a great training session just like, okay, I'm feeling good. You know, I'm feeling like I could be pretty dang effective if, you know, if the bad guy chose the parking lot of this, of this, gun range to cause a problem. Nice. but, right. You know, I'm joking, but I think that's a big common thing. You know, we think, oh, well, I train, you know, even if you're training every 2 weeks, even if, you know, or if you're training once a month, or more likely if you're training maybe once every 6 months, or, you know, what some people call training is going and just throwing as many rounds down range as possible. And, you know, not working on draw, not working on, you know, the fundamentals of marksmanship and all that kind of stuff. I mean, you know, there's a huge gamut of mistakes that we can make that make us think, oh, in this situation, I would be more effective. And you know, the whole purpose of me putting this article up is I wanted to kind of invite people to see things from a slightly different perspective that they're not maybe seeing things from already, or that what that's maybe not being talked about enough, right? And yeah. that's that good defensive shooting at its core is multiple rounds with good targeting, and like you guys talked about last week, with some good speed.
Yeah. Yeah. Shooting, you know, as quickly as you are able to accurately is mm-hmm. how I exactly. word it. It's pushing yourself to the limit of what is an acceptable accuracy and doing it as fast as you possibly can. So mm-hmm. this week we're talking about the title of this episode is To Chamber or Not to Chamber. And this is, of course, focused around the whole controversial topic. It's one of the most controversial topics amongst gun owners. Do we carry our guns with a round chambered or not?
Yeah, well, I think initially talking about the topic, you have to understand the context of, you know, carrying around in the chamber as far as, you know, for your personal defense firearm, you know, something that you have on your body, used it for a split second, you know, incident where your life or somebody else is at risk of death or serious bodily injury, that, you know, do you necessarily want to carry with a round in the chamber or not? And I wrote the article, you know, I tend to kind of pick these controversial topics and I like that. It gets debate flowing and different ideas. And I definitely like hearing opposite sides, but my opinion, you know, I'm not a sports shooter. I'm not a competition shooter or anything. My mindset has always been defensive training. And so my opinion on it is, you know, you carry with the round in the chamber, all the time. I'm sure you guys have your opinions too.
Yeah and that's go ahead.
I'll play devil's advocate a little bit. My opinion is the same. I think you need to have a round in the chamber because otherwise it's an awesome hammer. You could throw guns at people and maybe hurt them too, but you really need a round in the chamber. That said, I think, you know, what I hear from people who don't see eye to eye is, you know, that there's a huge safety concern, or maybe instead of calling it a safety concern, what I think a lot of people say, or why they feel so strongly about this, is they say, you know, to not have run of the chamber is a significant safety advantage. You know, there's a huge peace of mind. And I'll admit I'm guilty when I first, you know, before I was an instructor, but after I did have my first concealed carry permit, I thought of it this way. In my mind, I thought, well, if I don't have a round of the chamber, there's a significant greater amount of safety or peace of mind that comes because it's like, well, I know that there's that one extra step necessary to make the gun dangerous. Like it just can't go off if there's not a round immediately in front of the firing pin. And so that was kind of the thinking in my mind was it's just that extra cushion of peace of mind. That's why I remember doing it that way for years, frankly.
Today's topic is, I got my permit, now what? Mostly intended for newer CCWers, but good for all gun owners. We talk today through the most important things someone needs to do after and when they get their permit. Let's start with Jacob. Now, Jacob, let's just say you just got your permit. Now, in Colorado, that means you would have taken a basic CCW handgun safety course. But what's your next step, man? What do you do next?
Well, I'm thinking back when I actually got my first permit, and I think it's really hard to see beyond the actual permit for the student. I think when you're approaching that process, you make some sort of decision about, you know, I'm going to go, I'm going to do this, I'm going to take that one class I have to take, I'm going to get that permit I have to get, and then I'm going to like do stuff. But what that stuff is pretty cloudy in the mind. I think the average person, you don't see beyond that piece of plastic getting into your wallet. Once that plastic comes and it gets into the wallet, then you just kind of feel like, oh, I guess now I like carry around a gun, or I guess now I, whatever it is I intended to do, maybe some people, I, you know, I'm certainly willing to recognize they get that permit and that gun just goes into the car, or just they feel better about having it in the house or something. But I think most people just don't see beyond it at all. And so once that piece of plastic is in hand, it's sort of like, okay, you know, I guess, you know, I gotta like move forward.
That's a really good way of explaining it. I really like the way you phrase that. You know, the whole, they have a hard time seeing beyond the permit. Now, there's a quote. I say this in nearly every class I teach, where I say, for many of you here today, this is your end goal. This is like, you know, you had to get to the class. You know, you're going to apply for a permit, and you'll get your permit. And for you, that's it. That's the end of the road. And I try to explain to them that, no, really, this is just the beginning. Like, you just cracked the door open on this journey that I hope lasts the rest of your life of, you know, responsible self-defense. That to me is what a permit is, you know, or your initial training, is that it's just a crack in the door. And what's on the other side of the door? Oh, wow. It's a whole bunch of stuff. And there's a path, and it's a lifelong path of this being a lifestyle that's much more than just having a piece of plastic or a piece of paper.
Yeah, I think you nailed it. So let's start by talking about what are some of those things on the other side of the door. Like, I suspect maybe the in my mind, the way it makes sense to kind of address this is to talk about purchases. You know, what are some of the first things that gun owner probably needs to have in order to, you know, embark on the journey?
Yeah, you know, are we assuming that someone's already purchased a gun? Or are we just assuming that they haven't even purchased a gun? Because, you know, sometimes we get students like that where they're coming to a class, you know, and sometimes they're just coming through that class just so they can get some insight on what type of gun they should purchase.
So let's say that this person that we're, this theoretical person we're talking about has purchased a firearm and has received their permit and has taken a basic concealed weapons permit class as per their state restrictions. That's it.
Okay. I would say, based on that, and I think that's a great assumption to have made, so I'm glad we clarified that, I would say that for most people, that they are probably thinking, you know, after they've got the gun, you know, holster. I need a good holster.
Yeah. Well, for me, I want to start with, as even though, you know, coming from the holster manufacturer guy, I would recommend first to start with safety. Safety first. I would, and so, you know, one of the core safety rules is to always keep all firearms inaccessible to unauthorized persons, right? And so one of the first things that we want to do is we want to make sure that that we have a way to keep that firearm safe and only accessible by people who are authorized to use it. Now, you know, every single firearm these days is going to come with a basic gun lock, right? So you can take that, and depending on how you are trained, you can either put the cable lock through the barrel and out the extraction port, you know, the ejection port, or up through the grip and through the ejection port and down, however it is that you're trained, or, you know, like if it's a revolver, through the barrel or instead through one of the firing chambers so that you can't close the cylinder on the revolver, right? But, well, that's a good solution. I would recommend some type of a safe, especially for a pistol or a handgun. I would recommend as one of the first purchases you make, being a $100 to $200 small safe that you could put on your on your nightstand. That's the word that I'm looking for. Something where, you know, it's a little bit faster to access, you know, because it's like, the story that, always comes to my mind is, okay, I wake up in the middle of the night and bad guys in my bedroom. Oh crap, I need to find my keys and I need to find my magazine and find my gun and I need to unlock my cable lock and pull it out and put the magazine in and load the gun. You know, that's not going to set me up for success in that scenario. And so finding a safe to where, you know, my little girl can't get at it, but I can just go over beep, 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 and boom, I have my loaded firearm all set and ready to go. I think that's one of the first purchases in a handful of first purchases of a new gun owner that needs to be really high on the priority list.
That's a good point. And I agree with you. I don't think that a person should ever buy a gun without also, you know, buying a safe, of course. Mm-hmm. Now, here's the thought I was having when you were talking. Well, or really two thoughts, really. Number one is that I see a lot of times people come through my basic concealed carry courses in particular that many of them have been lifelong shooters, but they've been more focused on like hunting rifles and shotguns and, you know, hunting and stuff. And so they probably already have a safe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, it's probably some big 800-pound safe where they keep all their rifles and shotguns, and they might have a couple of handguns. They're probably going to keep them in that safe. And I'm trying to say that, hey, you know, you might want to consider some of these, you know, I call them quick access safes. I think they serve a purpose, an important one. It allows you to store responsibly a firearm and also still be able to access it quickly when you need it. You know, you're only going to find me without a gun on my person when I'm asleep. You know, that is a time of vulnerability for me personally. And so I will definitely have a quick access safe so that I can, you know, during that time of vulnerability, so that, you know, boom, I've got that quick access to a gun, you know, that's ready for use.
Yeah.
And also, too, related to that, you know, sometimes we talk a lot about on this podcast about protection of children, which is definitely an issue. You know, just a week ago here in the Denver area, there was a little boy that was shot, you know, by a gun that belonged to his father. And that should just never happen. You know, but I also recognize that we also have a lot of listeners to this podcast that don't necessarily have children or don't have children around. But keep in mind, it's not just children we're concerned about. You know, if your home was ever to get broken into, you know, even if you were at home or away from home, you are at risk of that gun falling into the hands of a criminal. And that is also something we really want to prevent. Today's topic, I stopped a stabbing in Detroit. Okay, on the line with us today, we've got Daryl Paco Sarter with us. Hello, sir.
How you doing?
We are great. you know, how did your day go as far as that day, that morning or whatever, getting ready for work, getting to work? Let's just start right at the very beginning. Lay it out for us in kind of a story form, if you would.
Yeah, so this day started off unusual right from the get-go because my shift usually starts, I work 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. But this day I was called in, I talked to my manager, we had an issue. You know, so we're like, she's like, why don't you come in an hour early and, we'll settle this and then you can start your shift at 10. So that day I went in at 9 o'clock and I had my, you know, shirt and tie and hoodie on. So, you know, sometimes it's hot days here, it's hard to conceal. So I had my hoodie on, so I still had my firearm on me. So we're in the office, you know, having our meeting and all of a sudden I see all these valet guys come knocking on the door. Hey, we need help. We need help. And yeah. I thought it was some of our valet guys getting into it, which either, you know how it is with that kind of stuff. So as I run out there, I just see it's like mass hysteria. People are running towards me, you know?
So I'm like, so people like, are running away from something.
Yeah.
In other words. Yeah, something. Before you go any further, would you explain the 10 minutes leading up to this incident as far as, you know, Were things kind of going normally, other than the fact you actually had to go into work a little bit earlier than usual? But was it just kind of a normal day for you, other than that?
Yeah, just a normal day, you know. Nothing out of the ordinary besides just having to go in early.
Uh-huh.
You know? Talk a little bit, Paco, about, you know, you mentioned you wore a hoodie so that you could continue to carry conceal. How long have you been, you know, carrying a concealed gun up to this point? I mean, is it years? Is it fairly new? You know, talk a little bit about your history with concealed carry.
I've been carrying for right now for about 6 years. I took my class with a 12-year Marine, you know. People always say, a lot of my friends are very anti-gun, or they say, why do you need a gun? When will you ever have to use your gun? And, you know, and I always told him, like, if I can go 30 years, 40 years, shit, my whole life without ever having to pull it out, then it did its job. But I would rather have it, you know, and not need it than need it and not have it, you know?
That's one of my favorite sayings. So I definitely relate to that. So you were carrying your gun that day. Is that pretty normal then? Do you carry on a daily basis?
I have it. I never leave the house without it, but a lot of times when I get to work, I leave it in my truck.
Okay. And was there a reason you didn't leave it in your truck that day?
Well, my thing was I was going to go in an hour early, have a quick meeting. I had my hoodie, which was concealing it, and then I was going to just take off and go have breakfast or somewhere and then start my shift later, you know? Huh.
That's really interesting.
So if it hadn't been for that meeting, yeah, you might not have had your gun with you in that moment.
Exactly, yeah. So that's why I said it was very odd. Like, we had to have an issue the day before for me to be called in, for me to go, for me to wear the hoodie and decide, hey, you know, I'm not going to ankle holster it or anything. I'm just going to just keep it right there.
Mm. Wow. Okay, so back to kind of, you're sitting, you said you're sitting in the office, and some of your valet guys, or they run over to the office and they're trying to get your attention. Is that what was going on?
Yeah, they're like, we need help.
Wow. So walk us through, you know, kind of moment by moment, what happens next?
So I come out, and this natural instinct is to run, you know. So I ran towards where I'm following them. They're just like, we need help. So as soon as I open the door, and I'm running towards them, and maybe 15 to 20 feet before I hit the exit of the door, I can hear, you know, her saying, bitch, you dead, if you want to go quote for quote. And you can just see this woman just getting attacked, you know. And before I even hit the exit doors, I was already unholstering my firearm, maybe, you know, 5 seconds before. And as soon as I got in my stance, I kept my distance, and I pointed right at her and said as loudly as I could, you know, if you want quote, drop the knife or I'll shoot. And she literally dropped it and backed away right away. And that's when other people decided to exit the door, and they moved the knife away. And that's when once the knife was out of her hands and she backed away and the knife was secured, I holstered my firearm right away and called 911.
Okay. So, go ahead, Jacob.
I was going to say, like, Paco, did you first hear or did you first see the lady?
I heard the bitch you did.
Yeah, so you're hearing that sound, and then what did you see? Like, give us, like, paint the picture of what you were seeing.
And big woman, just knife had to be 8 inches.
Was this like a kitchen knife?
Yeah, it was one of those long kitchen knives.
Mm.
And you can just see her. She was going at like a circular motion, you know?
Mm.
Yeah. Oh. And about the victim? Where was the victim?
At that point, by the time I got out, she was on the ground.
Yeah. Could you tell us, just because it may not be clear to the listeners, who are these two women and what's their relation?
The next day I found out they're mother and daughter.
Yeah.
Mother and daughter.
Yeah, mother's the victim, daughter's the perpetrator, right?
And daughter the perpetrator, yeah. And like if you've seen the footage they released, she walked in, went to the security, had her mother call down, and then they walked out, and you know, she had her hands behind her back the whole time, and then as soon as she went outside, she just went to town on her.
Wow. Do you know by chance, you know, why, you know, the daughter was provoked to or motivated to attack her mother in this way?
No, not at all.
Yeah. Huh, that's crazy.
Let me ask you, like, at that point, like, you're hearing the screaming, people are running, you catch a visual and you start going for your gun. Like, what was going through your mind at that moment? Like, do you have any memory of like your feelings or your thoughts in that moment?
No, actually, I mean, I didn't have any thoughts. It was just, someone's dying. I got to do something, you know?
It's just instinct. Would that be a good description?
It was instinct. It was adrenaline. And, you know, I mean, I don't really, it's tough, man. That's why, like, when you guys first wanted to even take me on right after that, like, I was shaken up after. I wasn't shaken up at the moment. It was like after, when I really thought about it, like, you know, what bugged me, like, man, what if she didn't drop that knife, you know? Like, I would have fire on her, you know?
Wow.
Yeah.
And it was the first time, like I said, it was 6 years, the first time I've ever had to unholster it with a threat. And, you know, all these years you carry and you're always thinking you're saving it for you or your family's protection. And, like, the last thing that came, like, the first time I would have to ever pull it out was to save someone else, you know, or help someone else.
So now, Jacob, let's get into today's topic: self-defense situations in which you should not use your gun.
Yeah, Riley, I'm excited to talk about this because we're obviously a firearm company. We believe in firearm-related self-defense. But, you know, we're the first ones to admit that there are so many situations in which either, A, you might just not have your gun with you, whether because you forgot or because it's not allowed there, you know, sideline, gun-free zone conversation, or because it's just not the most appropriate, you know, tactic. It's not the best way to respond.
Right, absolutely. You know, one very common situation, I'm just going to jump into one of these. It comes right from our article on our website. And I remember a Krav Maga instructor telling me very distinctly a number of years ago. And I thought it was really interesting because, you know, and this was a law enforcement Krav Maga course. And as law enforcement officers, we spend a great deal of amount of time, you know, training on firearms, you know, and making sure that, that we're well practiced, that we're qualified, that we meet a certain standard. And the focus is on firearms so much because it is kind of the last resort that save, you know, potentially may save our life. But there's a lot of other skills and things that must also be learned and must also be taught and must also be used. And I fear that sometimes there are law enforcement officers that even, you know, use tactics that, while maybe they might be justified at times, was it what they necessarily had to do? Like, if they had other skills that were better developed, you know, such as the hand-to-hand self-defense, you know, various hand-to-hand combat type, you know, techniques, would they have had to have gone to their gun if they could have done something simpler, if they had more confidence in their hand-to-hand skills? And so this instructor said something very interesting. He said, you know, and he's a law enforcement officer himself. He said, you know, if a guy has got a weapon and he's within, particularly like a gun, this is, I thought this was so interesting. He says, if a guy came up to me and he's 5 feet away. He's 10 feet away. And he starts drawing a gun on me. He said, I would rather use my Krav Maga skills on him than try to draw and use and fire my own gun. Because his point and argument was that this guy is so close that he can probably actually react faster and jump on this guy with his hands and using other various techniques, then he could actually probably get to his gun in the holster, deactivate all his various retention devices, get it out on target, pull the trigger and shoot. And that was eye-opening to me. Like, I was like, wow, you would rather, go hands-on with a guy that's got a weapon in your face than, and actually disarm him or do something else than, draw your own gun. I thought that was really interesting. So the first point in the article is, your attacker is too close.
Yeah, this is great. Most of us have been in the industry for a while, are familiar with the 21-foot rule, which has been debated a little bit over time. We talked about it, I think, at one point in another episode. But the general premise of this idea, and it was very popularized at the time it came out, and there's still a lot of clout to it. The general idea is that once your attacker is within 21 feet of proximity, they can close that gap to you faster than you can draw your firearm and respond with the firearm. And I'm not trying to draw some line in the sand and say, 21 feet, this is when. But to your point, Riley, and as to the point of the article that we publish on our website, there is some threshold, and it might vary based on circumstance, depending on how the other person's responding and your ability. But based on circumstance, there's going to be situations when they're just too close. And, it could be that tactically the firearm is not appropriate because it's going to take you too long. It could be because you're not going to be able to extend the firearm on target in a proper way. Or it might just be that you're going to be more efficient in terms of just some sort of hand-to-hand response. But I think, the theme throughout this entire episode, and so I'll say it now, and I think you already said it, and I'm sure we'll say it again, is you actually have to have that skill. Most of us as firearm guys or gals, we train a lot with firearm-related response because we figure as long as we got that down, we're good. But here's a situation where, no, not necessarily. Like, you maybe need some other skill. If your situation's a great example. If the other person's drawing a gun, he's 5 feet away, is this like a speed of the draw? Do I feel like I'm in the Old West? Like, well, let's see who can draw the gun fastest. Like, that seems like a really poor way to bet your life.
Yeah, it's exactly right, because, think about it. If the guy that, your adversary, if they are already moving to the gun or drawing the gun from their holster or from their waistband, can you beat them? Chances are you probably cannot. And so you're betting on the fact that their first shot or two is either going to miss or not incapacitate you immediately, because that's what it means. When they've already got the hand on gun, you've already lost that gun draw battle. Like, you probably cannot catch up and shoot them first.
All right. I hope you enjoyed that best of the Concealed Carry Podcast. Thanks again, everyone, so much for your support of the Concealed Carry Podcast. We really do appreciate it. We look forward to seeing you on the Wednesday episode coming up this week. We will have our usual episode, so we'll look forward to that. Catch you later. Be safe. Train hard. We'll see you later.
A reminder that laws vary from place to place, and we encourage listeners to seek local legal advice to understand applicable laws. USA Firearm Training and the Concealed Carry Podcast strive to share insights and stories about firearm-related incidents and laws, but things could be different where you live, or laws may have changed by the time you listen to this. We cannot be held liable for your actions based on the information shared in the podcast.